This is Classic Business, Breakfast with MoneyWeb, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
It's just gone 4 minutes after seven. Welcome to it. You're listening to Classic Business Breakfast with myself, Nastasia Aronsa. It's day two of the No Man United top this morning.
Hey, in my heart, they're still there. In my heart, they're definitely still there. So we'll keep things going along and hope for the best, of course, for the remainder of the season. I don't suffer alone, I believe. And surely Pete and I will attest to this. But nonetheless, let's get back into today's show, the Tuesday edition of Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. A lot going on across the board. South Africa trying to fix its economy a whole lot here. And questions are, but will the poor be able to benefit as we continue to do this? They need to be custodians of a growth in South Africa as well. So do they manage to form part of that growth structure as well as we fix our economy? We'll chat about that around 7:20.
And sticking with the same theme, one of the several challenges Ramaphosa administration faces is how to convert the president's political capital and support into business confidence. And according to JP Lundman, who's an independent political analyst, the numbers speak for themselves. We'll find out how does he get political support and get that to be business confidence in the end. We'll have that conversation in the middle part of the show.
Well, as you've seen, there are a few banks that have come up that have tried to change the way things are done, and perhaps a few other apps as well, considering how to change the fintech space. So we'll unpack just how the future of fintech in Africa is looking. Peter Zylstra from Orange Business Services will chat to us about just what we can look forward to beyond mobile money that happens at around 20 to 8.
And it came to light last week that public protector Busisiwe Mkhwebane was investigating Minister Pravin Gordhan's role in the early retirement package offered to former SARS Deputy Commissioner Ivan Pillay in 2010. We'll speak to the minister's attorney, Debogo Malatsi, who is the managing director at Malatsi Khanyane, about what he makes of it. And perhaps he can tell us what is the way forward from now.
It's the 13th of November, 2018, 7:06 is the time. Let's get into your Tuesday edition of Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
This is Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
Taking a quick look at the market, stocks in Asia fell in the morning on the back of the Dow Jones falling more than 600 points overnight. Japan's Nikkei fell 3% in early trade. Shares of Apple supplier Japan Display plunged about 7.6% in the morning. Markets in the Greater China region also started the day in negative territory. The Hang Seng Index traded down 1.6%, with the index heavyweight Tencent falling 3.7%. Stocks in Shanghai were lower by 0.25%. While the Shenzhen was marginally up. In overnight market action, the Dow Jones, as I mentioned earlier, dropping 602 points to close at 25,387, while the Nasdaq composite declined 2.8% to 7,200 by the closing bell. And the S&P 500 also saw losses of about 2% to close at 2,726. Over in Europe, FTSE 100 down 0.4%, the French CAC down 0.5%, and the German DAX down 1.3%, and over here the All Share Index down 1.9%, 52,259 points, and the top 40 dropped 2%.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
Well, on the line now is Jamila Ahmed, Global Head of Currency Strategy at FXTM, of course, and Martin Strauss, Director of ShareNet Johannesburg, is in studio with us. Let's just kick things off with Jamil, as we always do on a Tuesday. Jamil, thank you so much for the time. The Rand last week, having gone very firmly below that 14 Rand mark, now sitting back at around 1430 or so. It doesn't seem to be getting any more strength, really, from the market. Is there a sense of stability, though, now?
Interesting question, and thank you so much for having me. I think what's going on is that the market's been taken back by another relentless round of buying momentum for the U.S. dollar. So yesterday, the U.S. dollar reached its highest level in around 1 year and a half, which has pressured global currencies around the world. I can't stress that enough. It's emerging market currencies have been hit by this news because you've got a stronger dollar that's always weighing on emerging markets. But even your major currencies like the euro have fallen to their weakest level since June 2017, approximately. So what we're seeing again is a dollar strength story, a lot of dollar divergence, where traders just seem to want to pick up the dollar. Why? It could come down to two reasons. It's either optimistic central bank expectations from the Federal Reserve, but I do think this has been priced into the US dollar anyway quite some time ago, and it's not that much of a surprise that the Fed remain very upbeat on the US economy and central bank policy. Or there's some sort of anxiety in the air that perhaps the optimism that US and China were going to get a trade deal done as early this month maybe wasn't as sincere as what we thought. And there hasn't been any more updates on this news since we had that optimistic headline 2 weeks ago that Trump said that, you know what, they've got the potential to make a deal. And this suggests to me that investors might be piling up on the dollar because of concerns that trade tensions might highlight and raise up once again before they are scheduled to finally meet in Argentina later this month.
To circumnavigate the risks then for the emerging market space itself, would you then rather just, you know, straight up just head into the US dollar? Was there perhaps another way to perhaps look at avoiding the crunch that sort of is happening right now?
Generally speaking, the market environment in 2018, if you take away the first quarter, it has been that the dollar has been your go-to currency as a safe haven asset due to trade tensions, and the dollar has been the most highly bought. Gold also fell in line with dollar strength yesterday. So that's one safe haven asset we don't really see being as enticing as it would be in the past with market uncertainty. So that shows there is a lot of dollar strength because gold should be gaining more in uncertain times. Japanese yen, I would say this is the other safe haven asset that you can consider. Personally, I'm more favorable towards the yen than the US dollar, not because it offers that much more gains, but because it's very consistently performs as a safe haven asset. If there's market uncertainty, investors are very loyal towards the Japanese yen.
Jamil, appreciate your time there. Jamil Ahmed, Global Head of Currency Strategy at FXTM. Martin Strauss also joining us in studio, Director at CNA Johannesburg. Martin, yesterday equity news was a little bit glum. Vodacom came out with what I thought was a good set of earnings, but clearly the headline earnings per share number was read a little bit differently despite the one-offs that happened from one company to another.
Yeah, Arabile, I mean, first half profits down for Vodacom, 13.5% for the first half year on year. It has been weighed down by the issuance of new shares to reach black ownership targets. The market obviously a little bit concerned about that, dilutionary effects on the existing shareholders. It did raise its dividend payout, though, by about 1.3% or 3.95 rand per share. And as we know, a lot of investors do buy Vodacom for the dividend, but I think the outlook for our major telecom players does look a little bit gloom going forward.
Yeah, that kind of hurts a little bit, right, when you consider the fact that MTN is also not going through the best of patches. They did, however, Vodacom, that is, managed to get around 4.8 million subscribers in the 6 months to September, so that perhaps was a positive. But one that really got hammered yesterday, BAT, a really big one, British American Tobacco. How massive was that?
Massive for our market. It's a big chunk of our Aussie component. Is British American Tobacco. It's one of our top companies on the bourse, and you know it's actually lost about 40% of its value so far this year. Now, interesting that they've only had two annual declines in the past 19 years, sure. And this year they're down 40%. And now it's a new sort of wave of negativity for the tobacco space as a whole, as the FDA is looking to ban menthol cigarettes. So they've done some studies where they found the teens who smoke menthols actually smoke two times that of what people would ordinarily smoke on normal cigarettes, sure. And they actually want to ban it completely. Now, BATS is the biggest, is the most exposed to this, as menthol cigarettes actually makes up 25% of its profits. So yeah, it's got hammered by 11.3% yesterday.
Didn't actually know that. So do you think BAT then is losing its defensive stock sort of name and credibility?
I think it's been a perfect storm for the tobacco sector as a whole, and probably BATS has been quite negatively affected by it. I still don't believe that, you know, people just stop smoking menthol cigarettes, even if it gets banned, that they won't convert to normal cigarettes. Yeah. I still believe there, that people will continue smoking. I don't think the tobacco volume numbers have actually declined over the last 10, 15, 20 years, even though people are more health conscious. We do find a lot of other markets that actually consume more tobacco. If we look at sort of Southeast Asia and in Europe as well, in some countries. So I still think batches are probably a good buy at these levels. If I want to be buying when there's blood on the street, so to speak.
Yesterday we saw the tech stocks as well globally head downwards, and that seems to be hurting even the local stuff. Even the likes of Tencent, when you go out in Asia, seem to be hurting, and of course Naspers locally gets the brunt of that too. What's happening in that space? It used to be where the growth was at. Now it just seems to be, you know, getting hit as well.
No, absolutely. It's look, we must tell ourselves that it's run quite hard, that it might have been a little bit overheated if we look at it from the US aspect. But you know, not good news that Apple iPhone sales, that the outlook that's come from Apple looks weak. So we find that that sort of tech stocks on the Nasdaq sell off. As a result, the tech stocks on the Nikkei and on the Asian markets, those that are linked to Apple, maybe up or down the supply chain. And then as a result, you know, Tencent falls and Naspers falls with it. So yeah. quite a contagion effect on the in the tech space at the moment. And hopefully we can see a reversal towards the end of the year.
Martin Strauss, Director, Chiana Johannesburg. Just some quick earnings news as well. Telkom has come out with their interim numbers as well. That's just come out a moment ago. Operating revenue up 5.2%, my apologies. Headline earnings per share, however, dropping down 3.3%. Mobile service revenue going up 53.8%. That's just a quick look at those earnings. Hopefully we can unpack them a little bit more a little later.
This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
Just gone 16 minutes after 7. We're supposed to get Tebogo Malatsi on the line. He is the lawyer representing Minister Pravin Gordhan. That is because we're back at it again where, we do have Tebogo on the line to talk to us about what's been happening over the past week. Of course, we've seen, you know, at the heart of Busum Khabane's investigation into the pension payout of former SARS senior official Ivan Pillay during Minister Gordhan's first stint as finance minister. And at that time, Opa Magashule was SARS commissioner at the time. We're going to be talking about what's happening between the minister and the public protector's investigation. And to talk to us about it is Tebogo Malatsi. Tebogo, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Morning to you and your listeners.
So the last I checked, and perhaps you can give us a little bit more context here, but as far as the public understands, the NPA withdrew the charges linked to the pension payouts against Gordhan. And then Busisiwe received a complaint around it back in, I think, November 2016, and only acted on it in February 2018. What has happened between that time? Because there seems to be a lot of back and forth between what her office is saying and what you put out in the statement on Sunday.
Well, it's not too complicated in the sense that Minister only was told about the complaint made in November 2016. He only got to learn about that in February 2018. And we said, well, you know, like every other citizen, if I'm being accused of allegations of gravity, let me have the whatever you have, information, documents, and evidence of the allegations, and that was in February. Now, between February and now, which is now tomorrow when he must appear, we then have a discord about what is supposedly exchanges between us as his attorneys and them, and remember in their public office. We say we've asked for the information, we haven't received it, and we will appear tomorrow because we're required to do so by law,
yeah.
And that's where we are.
So she tweeted something that was quite interesting last week. She hit out at the minister saying that, you know, attorneys and advocates are not allowed to speak on behalf of a person under investigation by her office. The law only provided for legal assistance as opposed to legal representation. Is that right?
It's a technical question, interesting enough, extremely technical. Legal assistance means you are there as an attorney, as I would be, to guide the minister and to assist him on what he may or may not be compelled by law to respond to. Legal representation means the attorney speak on your behalf. And I think most of you will have some memory of the previous public protector's interactions in this regard and her position on it, which we think is correct. Minister must speak. We only there to assist him, not to represent him.
All right. So the minister will appear tomorrow before Busisiwe?
Yes, she will. He will very early in the morning. He's got another session in Parliament, mm-hmm. as I understand it, in the afternoon. And we've been able to arrange with the Office of the Public Protector for him to appear quite early in the morning.
Before I let you go, what are you hoping comes out of the meeting? Do you hope that you'll get a little bit more clarity in terms of the information the Public Protector's Office may have that perhaps might even give us a way forward?
Well, let's not forget, they have officially told us as his attorneys mm-hmm. that they do not have any evidence of wrongdoing on his part. So tomorrow's session is really about helping them to understand the sequence of events and factually, from a factual perspective, what it is that transpired in that period mm-hmm. when he made the approval as Minister of Finance for the early retirement of Mr. Pillay. So we're hoping that when we walk out of there, we've given them sufficient factual and documentary material for them to chew on and decide in the same way that the NPA did, that way to these charges.
All right, thank you, Temogo Malatjie, for your time this morning. Let's have a look at traffic.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
Well, President Cyril Ramaphosa has been on the investment offensive, of course, working hard to improve South Africa's economic situation. We saw him go to the Saudis and the Middle East, a while ago now, as he tried to garner up support for his $100 billion investment dream. And he then hosted the Job Summit. He also then tried to, in that summit, he expected to produce 275,000 new jobs a year. More recently, obviously, organized the investment summit, at which participants announced commitments worth 290 billion rand. He also announced initiatives to promote the construction of infrastructure, reform the tax regime. He also had just before the BRICS summit, China looking to invest a whole hoard of money into South Africa. But will any of this be of benefit to poor South Africans? That becomes the key element here, because otherwise we do begin to fear a few issues. Danny Bradlow, he's Professor for International Development, Developmental Law and African Economic Relations at the University of Pretoria, joins us now on the line to perhaps unpack some of those fears. Danny, appreciate your time this morning, Professor. Shall we unpack exactly how, if this doesn't benefit the poor, how big an impact it'll actually have?
Yes, good morning, and good morning to the listeners. Well, I think that the issue is, how do we assess whether it's going to impact the poor or not, and in a way or not? And as we know, the structure of the South African economy excludes many people, which is one of the reasons why poverty and inequality has not decreased since 1994. And so there's a real debate, a real concern that but if you continue with business as usual, this still won't benefit or reduce poverty and inequality. And so I think the only way you can really answer that question is to do impact assessments before you do undertake policy initiatives to assess, are you actually doing something which will maximize their positive benefits on questions like poverty and inequality? And I think in answering that question, the Constitution is a good place to start, because that spells out the rights of government and the rights of citizens.
Yeah. Do you think then the sustainability of this, I mean, the drive of this investment is clearly very necessary, but are we then plugging it perhaps in the right holes, or are we just perhaps saying we want all this money and putting it forward and it looks a whole lot more exciting, but isn't necessarily being put in the right areas to create developmental growth right from the bottom up? And are we just trickling this money from the top down?
Right. I mean, it's easy to get seduced by the large numbers, which are impressive. And as you say, we need investment. Mm. So there's no debate that that's a necessary push. But is it the right kind of investment? And is it going to have the right kinds of impact? And, you know, there's a range of things. We can't say you must put all the money into dealing directly with poverty and making sure that the poor benefit, because we have to, the economy has to grow, and that requires certain infrastructure, giving business some benefits so that they have incentives to invest is important, because if that doesn't happen, there won't be jobs. But there also needs to be care taken to make sure that it's being done in a way that has as positive an impact as possible over on progressively transforming the economy and delivering on the rights that people are promised in the Constitution.
Yeah, I suppose it's going to be an absolutely to try and mitigate, though, to try and continue the whole process. It's really a rock and a hard place, though, isn't it? Because you want to get the process right, but getting it right means that you kind of have to forego one thing and perhaps, you know, push on with another.
That's absolutely true. There's no question it's a very hard choice. Probably it's a given that we'll get some choices wrong and some right. Mm. But the part of the reason for doing impact and for understanding what we expect the benefits to be is it makes more transparent the process and allows people to assess, is the government and the private sector doing everything that they can? You know, is this the tough reality and we need to be patient that things will be delivered, but it's going to take time? And that will, you know, there'll be a debate because obviously we won't all agree, but at least we know that the issues are being given adequate attention and that they can be debated on their merits.
Yeah, Professor, I think it's one of those where you know the solutions themselves are definitely there, as you say, and certainly, as you said, we get a few wrong, we'll try and get a few right, but because we're now making inroads, we are pushing forward with trying to curb things like corruption, curb maladministration, curbing fraud. That certainly puts us in good stead then to be able to say, okay, yes, we may get the decisions wrong, but there is a greater good we're fighting for. And it sort of, you know, aims in that direction, and we help mitigate some of the risks and the fallacies that we perhaps get.
Absolutely. I mean, dealing with corruption, fraud, all of that is absolutely important. And there's definitely movement in that direction. But, you know, the government needs to make sure that each step it's doing, it's taking every effort to deliver as much as it possibly can. I'm confident that our people understand that everything can't be done now, but it's not unreasonable for people to expect government to show that it is making every effort, that it understands what people's needs are, and that it is making sure that what it does do will move things in the right direction, and not just keep doing business as usual, basically.
How do we measure any form of success or the impact that we may certainly have with these investments?
Right. I mean, it's very difficult, and obviously people will differ on what counts as a success. But I think if we do proper impact assessment, so we assess how will, for example, on the jobs issue, who will get the jobs? Where will the jobs be? What kinds of jobs will they be? Will they be temporary jobs, or will they actually be permanent jobs? Is there a strategy for how, if they're temporary jobs, there'll be a follow-up for that? How will the communities where the jobs are going to be created get spillover benefits from that? Things like that. That gives us a sense of how the economy is beginning to be changed to help people. Because I mean, the legacy of apartheid includes also spatial apartheid in cities, which hasn't really been changed since 1994. And if you're doing all this investment and creating all these jobs, is it being used in a way that brings jobs closer to where people live, that integrates different parts of cities together, that integrates rural areas into the South African economy, things like that.
Yeah. Professor Danny Bradlow, appreciate your time there, Professor for International Developmental Law and African Economic Relations at the University of Pretoria. Setting the stage there, South Africa set on fixing its economy, but will the poor benefit? 7:30 your news headlines.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arensa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
At 7:31, one of the several challenges President Cyril Ramaphosa's administration faces is how to convert the president's political capital and support into business confidence. And according to JP Landman, who's an independent political analyst, the numbers speak for themselves. And to talk to us a little bit more about it is the man himself, JP. Thank you so much for your time. Perhaps let's talk about, when it comes to popularity, how does President Cyril Ramaphosa fare? Perhaps even when you look at approval ratings from the time we had the ANC conference last year at NASRAC.
Good morning, Sasha. I think his political position has improved quite substantially. You will recall that at NASRAC, he was elected by a 52-48 margin. It wasn't a very big margin. And in fact, overall, his candidates, insofar as they captured seats in the top six, it was really much a 50-50 affair. I think it's quite clear now, 11 months later, that position has changed quite considerably over the last 11 months. And we've got a couple of pieces of forensic evidence. The first one is opinion polls, different sets of opinion polls, who tell us that the president's popularity countrywide is A, very, very high. High in the sense that it's far away, way ahead of any of his political competitors. That's number one. Number two, he's far more popular than the ANC as a political party. So there's no question that at this stage the president is an asset to his party, certainly not a liability. And as I've said, he's very popular in the country across all provinces, even in KwaZulu-Natal. His approval rating is sitting at 63% versus a 59% approval for the previous president, Mr. Jacob Zuma. Now, this is in KZN. This is in Mr. Zuma's home base and home territory. I think it's a highly significant number. So he's standing strong politically. There's no question about that. Mm. But as you've said in your introduction, the trick is how can he convert this political popularity and political support that he enjoys, how can we convert it into better business confidence?
But I can imagine from, you know, your perspective and some of the developments you're watching, there have been events that have bolstered the president's approval ratings. But is that enough to, you know, trickle into the kind of confidence we need? I mean, CEOs may say, yeah, we feel better about the situation and we feel like things have improved from where they were last year. But is it enough for us to see at least some business conditions improve?
On its own, definitely not. You need more than just political confidence. You also need, as you say, business and CEO confidence. And there the numbers are not that good. The CEO confidence index indicates a fairly high approval rating. Well, I shouldn't say high, a fairly okay approval rating. It's above the neutral line of 50. It's approaching a five-year high point. But it's by no means enough to tilt CEOs' decisions, I think. And if you look at the Business Confidence Index, which is run by RMB and the Bureau for Economic Research, then you see a fairly dismal reading. In the third quarter, it came in at 38, way below the 50-year line, and down from the 45 points in the previous quarter. So business confidence is certainly not there, and we also see it in the investment numbers. To answer your question, political popularity on its own is not sufficient. You need something more. And clearly what the president has decided to do is to focus on investment. Well, he's clearly focusing on two things. The one is what you can call ethical leadership. He's trying to clean up the corruption. He's trying to get rid of the legacy of state capture. And that in itself is important for confidence, make no mistake. The second thing that he's doing is he's focusing very, very strongly on investment. And as you know, he set a target of $100 billion US over 5 years to bring that into the economy. He had the investment summit. It was a big success. We will now have to see how much of this translates into actual investment on the ground over the next year or three. But clearly the president has tackled those two things. He's tackled corruption, ethical leadership, trying to go for state capture. He's done investment. I think the missing element so far, of which we haven't seen a lot, is what the economist would like to call structural reform. Now, what is structural reform? Well, simply organizing things in a better way so that we have higher productivity. In practical terms, you must sort out SAA. You must sort out ESCOM. There's a lot of structural issues that can be tackled in the economy, fairly low-hanging fruit, and I think that would really be the thing that will tip the scales. Having said all those, I think it's right, Natasha, to say that the issue of compensation, expropriation of land without compensation has to be resolved. You will not see an economic takeoff before that issue is not cleared off the table. And it'll be interesting to see how the president plays those balls over the next few months.
At the inaugural investment summit that took place about a week or so, we had some local and international companies pledging money towards investment for the next 5 years. But do you think we have what it takes to have sustained investments? Because, you know, it's one thing to have it now, but we need to be pulling it off every year where companies are actually willing to put money on the ground. Or do you think it's a sense where companies are playing a wait-and-see approach? Maybe things might change after elections. It's too early to tell, or how do you see the entire investment play?
I think there is a wait-and-see attitude. There is an attitude of let's wait for the election, absolutely. But I think that's why the president's investment drive is important. It can help change perceptions even before the election. And secondly, that's why I think the issue of structural reform is so important. Doing something concrete about SAA, doing something about ESCOM. Action looks like it's being taken at your competitors, at the SABC, which is also being subsidized by the taxpayer. Those are the kinds of actions that you need which will really tilt the confidence scales for the better. But to answer your question, do we have what it takes? Yeah, absolutely, we do have what it takes, provided we sort out the land issue, I've said that already, and provided we tackle these issues of structural reform. There's no reason why they can't be tackled. If Ethiopia runs a very successful state airline here in South Africa, in our own borders, Comair has been operating for 72 years. It's a very long time, and they never made a loss. So there's no reason why airline cannot run at a profit, no reason whatsoever why not. Sort out those fairly low-hanging fruit, and there's no question that we can do what it takes. Maybe just to give you a number to answer your question, the average of investment that we've had since democracy was around about 18.3% of GDP per year. In ordinary English, it would be about 18.3 cents for every rand in the economy. The average for South Africa for the last 70 years has been 21.7, nearly 3.5 percentage points more. Now, 3.5 percentage points may not sound like a lot, but you compound that over 20 years or you compound it over 30 years and it makes a huge, huge difference. So the investment summit pledges came to about 1% of GDP. If you can add that onto what we had last year and you keep on adding a little bit every year and you go back to that 21% level that we've had over 70 years, oh yes, it can make a big difference in South Africa.
JP, thank you so much for your time. That's JP Luntman, who is an independent political analyst. Let's have a look at traffic.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
Well, Africa is leveraging mobile and digital technologies in its own ways in order to bring financial services to people in some of the most isolated and underdeveloped places on Earth. Mobile money has found its biggest global foothold in Africa, and according to the GSM Association, over 57% of the world's mobile money accounts are located in sub-Saharan Africa, and the continent's fintech market has been forecast to grow from around $200 million in value this year to close to $3 billion by 2020. That's only 2 years. Peter Zylstra, Regional Director of Digital Transformation for Middle East and Africa at Orange Business Services. It's only 2 years, but it's going to be massive. Good morning, Peter. How are you doing?
Good morning.
Good morning. So I was just saying that it's absolutely only going to be 2 years in which we'll jump from $200 million US dollars in value in 2018 to close to $3 billion US dollars in 2020. What's going to spark this uptick?
Yeah, so if you look at the numbers, I mean, they're simply staggering. But I think what we see is two things in the market. One is an evolution, and this is partly a technology evolution from 2G to 3G to eventually 4G. From the, let's say, the feature phones till the cheap smartphones till the more sophisticated smartphones. But it's also partly a revolution, I would say. Revolution in terms of more and more people adopting these new technologies and willing to actually share money over the technologies, more and more players in the ecosystem who are stepping into this market, allowing now for microloans, micro insurances, peer-to-peer borrowing. So you can see that actually, it's quite getting heated in the market. Telcos expressing ambitions to become banks, and some of them have already become banks. Mm. So there's quite a bit happening in this market space.
Yeah, if we take a look at just the earnings of Vodacom here in South Africa just yesterday, a large portion of their earnings did come from M-Pesa, which is, of course, happening across the African continent. Maybe not so much here in South Africa on its own, but clearly the need for it is quite visible. Just how much growth exactly are you expecting to see just with just for South Africa on its own?
I just want to, you mentioned M-Pesa. It's an interesting example because it's often used as, you know, the proof of digitalization. But we see currently still 90% of transactions in Kenya are actually cash based. So what you see in South Africa, but also in Kenya, is that this transaction based economy, this cash economy, is rapidly moving into a digital economy. And that creates a lot of new services which will drive, I would say, the revenues that you hinted at before, the market uptake.
Yeah. So where does this mostly happen? I mean, yes, fine, we say the rural areas, but which countries seem to be aimed at the biggest growth areas?
So if you would plot, let's say, the users that are currently having a mobile money account versus the actual uptake of the services, I think you can see it quite mature already in Eastern Africa and partly also in South Africa. But the real growth for coming years is going to happen in countries like Egypt, in countries in Nigeria. In Egypt, for example, you have about 100 million population, out of which only 10 million currently have a bank account. Mm. Now, if the regulatory changes will happen, then you can, within the coming years, expect at least 10 to maybe 30 million people who will come into the banking system. These underbanked populations currently are almost waiting to step into that market. So phenomenal growth we expect in countries like Nigeria and Egypt and Morocco.
Sure. And some of the apps or the fintech players themselves who are making their mark, of course, we've just mentioned M-Pesa, but there surely is a little more.
Yeah, there are quite a number of interesting players. And what's interesting is that nowadays, it seems the access to capital for African fintech players is moving up. Is making it possible for them actually to expand their operations. As you know, the big challenge for fintech is obviously to try to get access to capital to invest in their solutions, the product, and obviously the marketing. Now it's much more easy compared to 2-3 years ago because we have some good solid references now in Africa of global fintech companies. Accelerant is one. Jumo is another. And they obviously become, the leaders for the emerging fintech industry. So it's becoming more easier for fintech to get access to capital. And it's also becoming a bit more easier to talk to the banks and craft partnership with banks and telcos. That was also different a couple of years ago. It was still a little bit of, wait-and-see approach, I would say, from the banks. But nowadays, banks are proactively reaching out to these smaller ecosystem players, these fintechs, and actually nurturing and making them part of their ecosystem.
Yeah, that's certainly very, very significant. Well, appreciate your time there, Peter Zylstra, who is the Regional Director for Digital Transformation in the Middle East and Africa for Orange Business Services.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arensa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
At 7:48, Arabile, we can't end the show without talking about Stan Lee.
No, we certainly cannot. I found out yesterday that Spider-Man was actually his favorite comic that he created. And it's quite interesting because I don't know if that is seen as the biggest superhero across his spectrum, that is, across the Marvel universe, that is. So it's quite interesting on that front that he actually thought Spider-Man was going to be a bigger hit than some of the other characters. And of course, he's the likes of Iron Man, the likes of Captain America, the likes of Hulk have clearly superseded. But when Spider-Man did come out initially, the first movie, I think it was in 2002,
mm-hmm.
it was a massive, massive hit. So yeah, look, RIP to Stan Lee. He really will be missed. And his cameos in the movies as well will certainly be missed.
So in the creation of Spider-Man, he used to work with somebody by the name of Jack Kirby. And he writes in his biography that when they started the character Spider-Man, he found that some of Spider-Man's sketches, the early sketches, made him too handsome and too confident. So what he wanted to do with a lot of his characters is that he wanted to create this personality where you weren't necessarily insulting the intelligence of adults, but you were creating superheroes who struggled with things like everyone else. Like they struggled with the fact that I'm having feelings for someone or I have allergies. Spider-Man had allergies.
Yeah.
And so he then got another artist by the name of Steve Ditko, who came up with the current look that we have for Spider-Man. And they introduced Spider-Man in 1962, and it became its own comic a year later and went on to be Marvel's most successful character.
Yeah, certainly did. And I mean, that's very, very, very huge, really, when you think of it that way, right? It's it was such a successful business that he sort of put together there
okay,
as well.
So here's a question. Of all the characters that he's ever created, which one was your favorite?
Wow.
I'm putting you in the spot.
Can I answer that before the close? Like, they're just far too many.
Okay, a top three. That can't be difficult.
Sure. Yeah, that's even worse, maybe even. Look, Spider-Man is certainly a big one. Iron Man is I think, was very significant. He didn't necessarily create it, but it came from a long stemming series in which he was a part of.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to give that to him as well and say, yeah. And I think if it's not Captain America, it's the Hulk. One of those two.
Okay.
But definitely there or thereabouts. Those are probably my favorite.
Okay. Me, it would have to be the Hulk, Spider-Man, and Doctor Strange.
Really?
Yeah.
Mind games, huh? Mind games. Let me give you something else of significant, you know, importance here.
Mm-hmm.
The Great Depression. You remember that?
I wasn't around, but I read about it.
I'm very thankful you weren't, because you might be a little different with regards to the age thing. Which
let's call Chris Gilmore.
Well, so that took place around the 1930s, right? Uh-huh. And beginning, of course, in the United States. The timing of the Great Depression varied across the nations. Mostly started between 1929 and lasted until the late 1930s. Do you know when the first superhero comic or the earliest superhero came about?
I'm going to guess
1938. 34.
Not bad.
And the first reference was to Mandrake the Magician. And then the comeback, the massive, massive comeback of superheroes, particularly in the last, you know, couple of years or so, was back in 2008 when Iron Man came out. Yes, there was, of course, Spider-Man, but the phenomenon recaptured the hearts of many people back in 2008. And guess what happened in 2008? It was the global financial crisis. I'm just saying that during tough times, people need superheroes. And clearly, we're managing to get that right.
All right. Well, we move on with the conversation. We're going to be talking about the Africa Investment Summit's benefit to entrepreneurs. And to have that conversation, we're joined by James French, who's the founder and CEO of ANC. James, thank you so much for your time this morning. I'm sure you caught a little bit of that conversation about Stan Lee and superheroes. So we can't start this interview without you telling us who your favorite superhero is.
Oh, my Lord. So that's a funny one. It's a really sad day that Stan Lee passed, but when I was a kid, I couldn't go a day without reading The Avengers and Hulk and Thor. They were all part of my life. They were so human, but, you know, obviously more than just human. So I can't say I have one favorite. I just like the big brawl.
All right. That's good enough. So the Africa Investment Summit, I mean, you know, in your opinion, was that a good start? Like we had the investment summit that took place about a couple of weeks ago?
I do. And I think that's how you should see it. I think you should see it as a model that that will grow and improve. But the basic concept is that it's a platform. And we have to be thinking in terms of platforms to address the kind of the long-standing intractable problems of economic development. So find what works, tweak it, improve it, do it again next year.
And key takeaways for you?
Well, I hosted the panel titled Taking Africa's Tech Space to the Next Level. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, personally, I think that was the most exciting panel because although it doesn't get a lot of play, technology in Africa is going to have a dimension in every single sphere of investment. And investing in tech means investing in data. And the data that comes from African economic activities will be able to be used to apply to solutions for other problems. So you invest in a smart payment system to make payments between point A and point B, and the data generated can be used to solve a problem related to education. And so the trickle-down effects of understanding the value of Africa's data and allowing Africa's ingenious entrepreneurs to use that data, those effects are really unlimited and will be revolutionary.
On the tech side, we had a conversation about this, I think, last week with one of our guests, and we were talking about how whenever people think of technology or whatever fears of technology, whether it's AI or virtual reality, whatever's coming out of there, we always think Silicon Valley, we think Amsterdam, we think London. Not really, people don't really make that connection with Africa. And I wanted to get a sense from you, perhaps, why is that? Or are you starting to see that, you know, people are starting to look at Africa very differently, especially when it comes to technological innovation, perhaps in other parts of the continent?
That's an excellent question. I think that, first of all, you mentioned Silicon Valley. Look at Silicon Valley's view of Africa. Silicon Valley recognizes that Africa is home of the next billion users of its platforms. And so some companies are running about offering free connections to Wi-Fi. And the real issue for Africa in that bargain is to say, what do we want out of it? What is our agenda in this? Do we want free connection to the internet, or do we want access to data? And I think the latter is the wiser move. In terms of African innovations or innovative African tech people, I was on stage in my panel with Silas Arinkule. He was CEO and founder of Reach Robotics. He's the most successful robotics engineer in the world, including Silicon Valley. And he's invented an AI, AR robot that interacts with people in an ingenious way. So imagine Pokemon Go, but there's a robot, a real robot in your game. He's a Nigerian. He was on stage. There were others who did drones, Atlan Space, who started a drone company, and they do geotagging of farmers' land so that you can produce titles and find out who is planting what, and that spills into the capital markets. So it's a myth to say, and we hear it perhaps often or in the subtext, that Africa is not on the forefront of the technology wave, but it is. The most important thing, really, and the point that I would like to get across to your audience is that where we should start is focusing on data, access to data, because that data can be used to solve really important problems like developing SMEs, helping fill skills gaps for SMEs. That's in fact what I'm doing in my own work. And I think that once we understand the value of data in Africa, we can really try to put it to work to solve a lot of the problems that have been so resistant for so long.
James, thank you so much for your time this morning. That's James French, who's the founder and CEO of ANNC.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arensa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
South Africa is facing a savings crisis, and retiring well should be a priority for each and every working South African. Don't be a statistic, a part of the population who is not planning ahead and saving for the future. Take charge of your retirement journey. Join MoneyWeb and Liberty for our one-day Retire Well Masterclass on Tuesday, the 20th of November, where investment experts will share their insights on a number of retirement subjects. This masterclass will take place at Summer Place in Sandton. The first five people to email MoneyWeb with the heading Classic 1027 Retire Well at events at moneyweb.co.za stand a chance to win a free ticket.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arensa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
Well, we close out the show now, but just before we do that, the biggest one-day rise in the oil price in more than a month is expected to not derail the chances of a petrol price cut for the month of December. That'll certainly be good news for motorists. And President Cyril Ramaphosa is staring down Tom Moyane and saying that he will not indeed withdraw his decision to fire Tom Moyane as South African Revenue Services Commissioner. And Tom Moyane saying that he will now take the matter to court. Also, the International Finance Corporation says investors are more excited about South Africa under the leadership of President Cyril Ramaphosa than they were a year ago. So some good news coming to the fore. Peter Terry, your favorite Marvel character that Stan Lee created?
Well, being a superhero myself, it's a bit of professional jealousy. So.
Well, that's where we close out the show. We'll do this again tomorrow.
Goodbye.